it takes two generations on average for multi-generational wealth to have been exhausted to zero. If you have that desire to have a more classical model of wealth and stewardship across more than just your own lifetime, what are you supposed to do to prevent becoming a statistic?
Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.
Now, Mark, let me just review you to get your head back in the game. We're in the middle of a large series about protection and how to be a protector of all of the capitals that come into your world. So we want to be gaining capitals such as ideas. We want to be gaining physical capital. We want to be gaining relational capital. We want to be gaining financial capital. And we're doing a series about protecting all of that stuff once it comes in. So we're starting at the bottom of the food chain and working our way up. We're starting with financial. You have talked to us about how not to lose the money that you already have, how to protect that money. Then you talked to us about how to protect the money that you expect to come in. How do you protect your future earnings? And before I introduce what today's topic is, I would like to say on behalf of the people, I would like to speak on behalf of all the listeners and say, Mark, we are in your, what's the word? We're in your debt. That's what I was going to say. We're in your debt for you bringing the breadth of knowledge that you have on this topic. I'm always amazed at what you have at your fingertips. And I think it's a great series. I appreciate your intelligence on this, the intellectual capital that you have gathered over the years that you're just giving it away. So anyways, I'm pumping you up here so you don't blow it on the last one about the financial capital. So today we're talking about how to think multi-generationally about financial protection. That is to say, I've got money. I want to hold on to it until my dying day. I'd like my retirement years to be funded. We speak about retirement. I'm speaking that with quotes around it in big brackets. But until the day I die is my point. But how can I protect that thing getting handed off to my generations? Because I believe that my money isn't just for me. I believe it's for my generations, for my family. With that said, I'm just going to hand it over to you and you're going to start walking us through how we can protect our money long, long term.
Yeah. And as we get started, I think I want to chuckle together. Let's just have a little laugh at the fact that when we first contemplated this whole protection series, I thought we should do an episode on protecting all five capitals. And here we are starting on episode 3 of one capital. So I don't know why my brain works that way. I just thought we could get it all out in 1 hour.
We could not.
I couldn't. Maybe a better man could. But, you know, multi-generational is kind of a buzzword for our listeners. A lot of people, they want to talk about multi-generational wealth, multi-generational family team on mission, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a really fun thing to talk about. And most people that talk about it don't ever actually do it because it involves sacrifice. It's not something you can get excited about because you listen to a couple podcasts and then you go do. Like, you could do something, even something huge. You could go take a whole 6-month family sabbatical and travel Europe because you got really excited and you did it and then back to the normal. But multi-generational anything, the principle of the whole deal is that you're going to do this slowly over your whole life, and it's going to involve mostly work whose fruit you will never see. Unless you happen to be one of these hyper-blessed people in our time who are the product of a multi-generational family, then you may never actually see any multi-generational anything, even if you're doing it from the time you're 25 until the day you die. I take that back. You'll see children, grandchildren, things like that. Praise God, Lord willing. But you won't see the sixth or seventh generation that it's kind of the thing we're all going for. So
right. It's like planting the trees down the drive, all the way down the long drive.
Exactly.
And you might die and they're never going to have that beautiful thing where they meet over the road and create this wonderful tunnel to drive through. Might never.
Right. So I don't say that to discourage you, but I do say, let's, as Abraham's Wallet people, not be LARPers when it comes to multi-generational talk.
Challenging. A little challenge up at the top of the episode here.
Yeah, I think it's a risk. Let's talk about when we've got money, we protected it. And then we've protected the future streams of income. So now we've got money and we're still bringing money in. Wealth, financial capital, I'll say.
And but, are we gonna pretend that you've also done a bang up job at creating kids? Are you gonna handle that?
Let's just say you've done a better than average job. You don't have to have 12 kids to have a multi-generational family.
No, I mean the quality of kid. You've created
well,
kids.
We're gonna talk about that for sure.
Okay, all right.
But the problem you face now is that the typical American path, and I'm a financial planner, so I have people all the time that walk through the virtual office doors and say, hey, we would like to do retirement planning. And the typical even financial planner that hears that, they think, your goal is to make sure that your basic needs are taken care of and then give you as much freedom as possible to use that money to delight yourself, whatever you've accumulated, until you die, and maybe even leave a little bit so that your kids can have fun.
A little bit of icing on the top that the kids could like have a nibble of.
Right. And when we talk about multi-generational wealth, we're basically breaking that entire model and saying the purpose of wealth is a much more classical vision of family, which says this family stewards resources over time. And the goal is that everybody that comes along would feel the weight of that responsibility. Not just I'm supposed to find my way in the world and be successful. Those aren't bad things. We want our kids to feel the need to work and produce. But it's not a very American thing to think part of my responsibility is to receive and grow this family's wealth. That's not thought of as a thing. We've done whole episodes on this where we talked about some of the bazillionaires of the world who have sworn off any inheritance for their kids. I think Warren Buffett said $250,000 would be passed on to each of his kids, and beyond that, he's giving the rest away. And the statistics say that that's probably a wise move, because statistically, people who inherit money, their lives don't go very well, especially transformative billions of dollar type money. And if Mr. Buffett or anyone else is thinking like a investor, it takes two generations on average for multi-generational wealth to have been exhausted to zero. So in this episode, we're going to say, if you have that desire to have a more classical model of wealth and stewardship across more than just your own lifetime, what are you supposed to do to prevent becoming a statistic? And I'll tell you right now, the culture's set up against you. The law is set up against you. We have a tax code that is going to try to make this very difficult. And the odds are not good. If you just say, I'm going to raise good Christian kids that love Jesus, that's not enough here, unfortunately. They might be an inheritance from the Lord who are going to reproduce other Jesus lovers. That's obviously, again, we're talking about the capital at the bottom of the pyramid. However, they are not likely to just happen to become multi-generational stewards of wealth. And so what I want to talk about for a minute is, what can you do to set yourself up maybe for an odds-defying run when it comes to multi-generational wealth?
Awesome. Let's go.
So you're interested in multi-generational wealth. You're not going to be a LARPer and just talk about it. You're going to do it.
Right.
What's the biggest risk to multi-generational wealth?
The biggest risk. So I'm reckoning that by the end of your life, you've got a pile of money that you've been so faithful with. And I know that the government is sharpening its knives to try to get at that. We can talk about that in a minute. But I think probably the number one risk is that the people that mountain of money is going to are going to be really stupid with it.
Ding, ding, ding. It's not the 40% evil estate tax, even though that's a huge bite. It's that you're going to have dumb kids. That's the biggest risk. So we'll link to an article we wrote a long time ago called Scary Stories of Inheritance Gone Afoul. But there's just example after example of people who have come into sudden piles of money, whether it was through inheritance or lottery or things like that. And they always blow it, it seems. We're going to finish this episode talking about some of the legal moves and things like that that you can make to protect wealth over generations. But the number one thing you must be thinking about is not just a desire to train kids with money, a training plan for your kids. I used to race bicycles and I had a lot of desire to be fast. And there were times where I just went out and rode and rode. I didn't get faster. When I got faster was when I set and scientifically programmed specific intervals of work and chunks of intensity and rest and nutrition and all that. You got to think that way if you want to have a hope of creating kids who aren't part of the typical statistical soup and even with good intentions are going to blow all your money.
That's a great point. So are you saying, Mark, that like a lottery winner who has spent their life doing dumb things with money, like buying lottery tickets, when they get a huge influx of money, are you saying they don't overnight have the skills for caring for huge amounts of money because they didn't build up any skills in their life? And you're saying that getting an inheritance that you didn't earn and you didn't build up any skills to take care of it is like getting amounts of money from a lottery when you did a dumb thing to buy a lottery ticket and then there's a dump truck of cash? Are you saying that if you don't have skills, that having a lot of money is maybe a bad idea? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I'm saying all of those things.
Oh, okay.
So we want to give you some tips for this training plan. Some of you guys are listening and you're like sharp cookies and going, I know I can create the training plan. Thank you for the motivating attaboy slap on the behind. I'm at it. But most people would like a little bit of guidance. So here's my thoughts on this. All of this is stuff we've said before. So if you're a longtime listener, I hope it's a refresher. If you're a first-time listener, just keep going back through the archives and you'll get deep dives into each of these things. But
all right,
here's my first kind of money handling tip for it works for two-year-olds all the way up to adult children. Set up situations that increase in consequence for your kids to spread their wings when it comes to money. So for me, that means simple things. I've talked about going to the grocery store with little kids and I will hand them $5 cash and I'll say, you must spend this. Go do that. And the reason that I do that is because I know that a little kid is going to go buy the junk plastic toy the first time we try this. Like, it's just, maybe some of your kids don't. Maybe they go, I'm going to buy the delicious treat that I love to eat. But many, many times I've seen kids go for the junk where you roll your eyes and go, really? Another tiny stuffed animal or whatever. And I actually, that's why I do it, is because I could tell them, we all tell our kids, that's not a good buy. What I want them to experience is feeling like they made a mistake with spending. And that's not because I'm cruel. It's because I actually think that part of my job is to teach them through a low consequence experience. Like, I want you to buy the dumb crap so that you can reflect on it. And if I'm successful, maybe your older sister bought something delicious. I don't know. With $5, you could get a whole box of drumsticks and have a week of joy. I'm talking about the ice cream novelty, not the chicken leg. But, you know, I want the sad 5-year-old to look at the delighted 8-year-old and go, My toy broke in 15 minutes after I got home from the store, and my sister over there has had a week of ice cream novelties. I made a bad choice. And then we kind of ratcheted up from there. I've talked about like this idea with my oldest daughter. She invested a big chunk of money that she had saved and earned in a business venture with the dog breeding. And there was a minute there where we're still not 100% sure how it's going to shake out, but we thought that we had a total loss situation, not a pregnant dog, which would have meant like $1,000 down the drain. And as tempted as I was to go like, oh, I'm going to backstop you, don't worry, I didn't do that. I said, there's a chance you're going to lose all your money if you do this. And the return is high. You're going to make more than you could ever make at a summer job doing this if it goes well. But again, I just want to think about whether it's spending, investing, giving. I want them to make decisions both that will be rewarding and good, but I also really want them to screw it up when it's low consequence and they can learn those lessons so that they're not like me and go out and say, I'm going to deploy $100,000 in a bad investment when I'm young and see it go to zero in 24 hours. And have to take that kind of punch in the face. Like my goal, like I learned that lesson. It was actually very helpful. My goal is to teach my kids so that they don't have to get to that point and take lessons in kind of the same hard way that we learned some of those money lessons.
Okay. I think those are two really helpful ideas. One is handing your kid money in a grocery store, cash. And one is letting them lay out some money to start a business venture. Can you give us a couple of more that would do that kind of thing for training your kids in case people are kind of like, that feels like a black box to me. Like,
yeah,
train your kids financially. What else do you do?
Yeah. I mean, people vary on their opinions when it comes to allowance. We don't do an allowance that's just because you exist, you get spending money. But what I have done as my kids have gotten older, and if you go back, my daughter and I did a whole episode on this together, but I looked at my budget, which is something I start introducing the kids to very early. Hey, we have a budget. It tells us if we have enough money to spend on this or that. They're like, yeah, cool. Can we still do the things that we want to do? What I have found is a very helpful way to teach them about this is actually transfer the budget to them when they get to a certain age. So for me, when I had a 13-year-old, I said, I have always budgeted for you to have clothing. I think that it's a good thing that when you have a friend who has a birthday, you should be able to bring a birthday gift to their party. I want you to have money you could call this allowance, but go get a smoothie after school with your friends if we're not going to be there for a few minutes. I think all those are fine. I don't mind funding them. I have set aside an amount of money for that. And up until that age, I've been the one budgeting. I've been like, here's how much we have. No, you can't buy those new shoes because we don't have any money left in the kids' clothing budget. What I do when they turn 13 is I transfer it to them. And again, I'm excited if they mess it up a few times early on because I want those lessons learned. But Air Jordans on week one of managing your annual clothing budget means we're going to have a whole lot less new clothing this year.
Do you feel like your oldest is getting better and better at that?
Yeah, so it's been really fun because she has thoughtfulness now on not just how does my sneaker purchase affect my ability to buy the jeans I want, but also she can kind of create her own budget. I'm not saying here's your clothing budget and here's your gifts budget. And I said, here's what you have and here's what everything I expect you to cover.
Right.
With it. And so she can make those trade-offs. I'm actually going to skip on some clothes I wanted because I really want a nice gift for my friend for her 15th birthday. And I've loved seeing that. We talked about Fidelity Youth, which is an account I really like for doing this. And the nice thing about that account is that it also allows them to invest. So in one app, she can do her spending plan. She has a debit card, which I actually think is a positive thing. because nobody's using cash in 20 years from now, I think. But she can also go, when I have extra money left over at the end of the month, I invest that. I can choose investments. I can watch it grow. There's some reward there. So Fidelity Youth, good app. The practice, though, however you choose to do it, you can use a savings account. You can use paper envelopes with cash. Transferring some of the spending decision-making over to your kids earlier is generally, I think, a really helpful strategy.
You're giving us practical ways that you are building a person that you can trust with your multi-generational wad of cash that's going to be there when you're ready to pass that along. That's very helpful.
The next thing that I have down is maybe a little bit less tactical, but we often talk about a budget as a funding plan for your family vision. We like family visions. We get really excited when a family has a specific drill down. This is why we exist. This is what we think God put us on this earth to do. And one thing I see as a potential obstacle to multi-generational wealth is when people create a family vision that is like, me and my wife, this is our thing, and it's not expansive enough, adaptable enough, and flexible enough to incorporate my kids. So, example, we are a family that's built to worship the Lord with music, and everything we do is music. And then you have a kid that goes, I'm an engineer. I guess I'm not part of this. I see this sometimes with like foreign missions families. They're like, we're to reach the lost in the third world. I feel called to live in a big city in New York City. And that's where, whatever it is, some of this is, it's okay to create a culture in your family. So I'm not saying make it so generic that it's meaningless. I'm not saying that. It's fine to say we're a family that prioritizes generosity above all else when it comes to money. But what is very important, I think, when you're creating a family vision statement is that if it's too rigid, it's going to be abandoned by your kids. They might still walk with the Lord and be wonderful people, but they're not going to feel that sense of identity and connection to something that's so prescriptive that they go, if I'm outside of that a little bit, it's not me. And if it's too vague, again, it won't matter. So we exist to love Jesus and love others. No, I'm not saying do that. I'm just saying what you want is to craft a family vision and be willing to mold and adapt it as you see, whoa, the Lord has put an engineer in our family. Why would he do that? What can we learn about his plan and his desire for our family? He put an engineer in the middle of an artist family. He did that for a reason. And so what I want my kids to see is me paying attention to them and thinking of them as the key assets in the multi-generational vision that I'm saying we're crafting this around the assets, whether they be financial or more important things, that the Lord has put in our family. And I think that's a really important thing for your kids to see happening in real time.
That's great. Let me just put a little bit of wheels to what you're describing. What we recommend is that people think in 18-month windows regarding their vision. So when you've got a newborn and a two-year-old, you're not really considering, now, what are the gifts in our children? You're just going to look, this is who my wife and I are. We might have enough margin for one time a month for us to do something that's specifically kingdom-oriented. But when we do, we're both teachers. So we look for opportunities to make sure that each other can have a teaching opportunity. Okay, that's who we are. So that's our vision. As your children age and you start to see their gifts come to life, and hopefully you're training them in their gifts, just like you're training them with finances, as they get older, then you understand, okay, our vision for our family isn't just the wife and I. We have to incorporate these gifts. And I just totally agree with Mark. You've got to shift the way that you are framing your family vision, that who we are is absolutely part of, and it's going to be starting to be weighted even more on the children than it is the adults, the parents. So as they get into their 20s and 30s and 40s, now you are serving them as part of, they're going to be the drivers and they're going to be carrying the heavy weight as far as the family goes. So we need to be shifting this thing in a way that they can work into it. We've seen this happen beautifully, if I may refer to one of the great local multi-generational families we've had on the show before, which is the Beauséjours, the French Canadian family that's in Cincinnati. And Dennis, one S, one N, the French way, Dennis, he has morphed as he has gone into traditional retirement years to seeing that his role more than anything else is to serve his children's families. And so his vision for his family, which he still has this very important patriarch role, he presides at big family gatherings, et cetera. But he sees that the juice in the family right now is with the 20, 30, 40s set. While he's moving off of center stage, he's taking on the supporting role. The framing of the family vision puts more weight and more the star power in that middle age set because, as I said, they're going to be taking the bulk of the responsibility. They're the one raising little kids. So if he wants to hold on to the glory of the past, this is what I do so good. I'm 65. Shouldn't I be the star of the show? No, it's time for you to get into the wings and start serving. You got to become the Merlin tutor for the young King Arthur, right? You have to take on that responsibility. So I think the way that you shape family vision is part of that. And I know I'm just repeating what you're saying. I'm just trying to make it super practical for people.
I don't think you are repeating what I'm saying, Steve. You took the golf ball of wisdom and you set it on the tee for me. And I'm
hallelujah.
Man, I am ready. The negative is sometimes when it feels like it's a perfect wide open fairway and I can just blast away, that's when I hit it into the pond.
I know. You can find a bush. Somehow you'll find a bush.
Let's hope that doesn't happen right now because you've teed it up for my final point,
okay,
which you've kind of already made, but hand off the, I said financial baton, but it's really all the batons way earlier than you think you should.
Yeah,
and waiting until you're 80 to hand over any aspect of spiritual or family leadership or financial leadership to the next generation is stupid and it's a waste. We've seen it personally where some crusty old dude when he's in his 70s and 80s goes, I think I'm about ready to hand over the reins to the next generation. And the next generation goes, we're 60. We're 55. Yeah. We have
too
already
late.
Built everything. Like, you didn't invite us into that. And now, I guess, we'll take your money if you need a place to put it. But it's going to serve the thing that we've built that we didn't have any help with. And so this can look a whole bunch of ways. But some of the things I'm doing to already start prepping that is I'm like, okay, kids, it was really stinking hard for your mom and I to pay for private school when you guys were really little. We were just getting started financially and we do great. Praise God, he's given us the means to do that, but it took like pretty significant sacrifices. We're saving now to help you with that because we're going to be like behind you pushing when you're at that age because you're not going to be alone. You're not going to be alone physically. My wife keeps a journal that she calls the grandmother journal. And anytime, this might sound like she's fussy, she's not. She has a great relationship with her mom, who's a very helpful and active grandmother. And yet, Amelia goes, anytime I notice, man, it would be nice to have this type of thing happening right now, I write it down and I go, I'm keeping notes so that I can improve upon the foundation that my mom has laid for grandmothering.
That's tremendous.
You talked about Dennis and his, I believe with one N, the French pronunciation would be Denis, right? Grandfather Denis.
As the French say, CC.
I think they say we.
Okay.
The cool kids in Paris, they said we.
Yeah.
Not we. But I think that episode that he did on grandparenting, I listen to it annually as a shot in the arm of this is what I'm angling for. And I think he would even say, I'm setting a floor, not a ceiling for my kids. They're going to be doing better than I did at this when they're managing relationships and supporting their kids in adulthood and their grandkids. So handing over the baton way earlier than you think you should. I envision, and I talk about this, I have daughters, so I talk about this with my daughters. I'm like, part of why I really care about you guys finding great husbands is because I'm going to be saying to those husbands sooner than you think, I want you guys to be the leaders of this family, and I'm going to follow where you're going.
That's right.
It's not like old Mark is going to be sitting at the table going, well, here's where our family's headed and who's coming. I'm not.
That's right.
Going to be going where their husbands are leading.
I mean, this is part of the culture of our family, is that our family will be looking for a husband for you. Our family will be praying for this. And I've made it very clear. We're now on the front end of the interest in dating years. And I have continued to make it very clear, even this week, that whoever you date at some point is going to have a relationship with me. I'm going to have a relationship with this young man. I don't have to be there every time that y'all are together, but he's going to have a relationship with me. And that relationship must grow as your relationship with this young man grows, because I'm going to have a very intimate relationship ultimately with this guy that is, as you say, in 40 years going to be leading our family. And I'm going to be handing over the reins, all of the financials of our family, to this guy, hopefully before I'm dead. Yeah, it matters a whole lot to our family. What I think is a tragedy is sending your daughters out into the world, I hope they make good decisions with who they choose to marry, because we'll just have to be on the receiving end of whatever decision they make. But I don't think that's a terrible plan for your long-term vision for your family. All right, enough of the training of kids. Let's get into some of the technical stuff about what's the government's plan at getting at our multi-generational money that we're trying to put aside. So yes. Talk to us a little bit about estate tax.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about the estate tax at the very end. That's going to be the last thing I cover.
Oh, okay.
But most people, I'm going to spoil my big point. Many people won't actually have to worry about the estate tax. And the thing that everybody that has children needs to worry about, though, is what happens to my stuff and my kids when I die. So the very, very basic thing that if you are listening to this and you have not created a basic will, and if you have kids, that should include guardianship provisions for your kids and powers of attorney, healthcare powers of attorney, who gets to decide what happens to me if I'm in a coma and I can't make decisions, and legal powers of attorney, meaning if I'm in that coma and my wife is going, Mark had all the access to all the accounts. They were in his name. We should probably fix that in the long term. But in the short term, if she has a legal power of attorney, she can show that to the bank and she can act on my behalf. Those are critical. Do not let the state that you live in be the one who decides what happens to your kids if something happens to you and your spouse. We absolutely want you to make that decision. We'll put a link in the show notes to an online tool that we think is great for accomplishing that. You don't have to use it. We get nothing from them, but it's just a tool that I found helpful. And it's inexpensive DIY. You can, in an hour at your kitchen table, create a will, both of these powers of attorney and guardianship instructions for your kids. That's table stakes, okay? Briefly, I want to also mention trusts. So a lot of people go, do I need a trust? We've done whole episodes on trusts. We can link to those in the show notes as well. But what a trust does is it is its own entity that allows basically you to speak for yourself when you're no longer in a position to speak for yourself, because either you're disabled or more likely, you're dead. The most common type of trust that people will use who aren't in a ultra high net worth bucket is called a revocable living trust. It means you can take things in and out of your trust, but whatever is owned in that trust when you die is still owned in that trust. Unlike if I own a house in my name and I die, hopefully we took Mark's advice and we wrote a will, and that will is going to get taken to something called a probate court, and they're going to take 9 months and eventually get to a reading of the will and adjudicating your case. And hopefully someday the house that you owned in your name gets handed over to whoever you wanted to own it. But you don't have to have any of that. None of that has to happen because you could have owned the house in a trust. And if you die, guess who still owns the house? The trust. The only thing that's changed is the beneficiary. So now your kids are the beneficiaries of the trust. And they're like, this trust that we control is the owner of a house. No probate court, no chance for crazy Uncle Tommy to come in and dispute the will or whatever. And so I think that that's the order is first, make sure you have a will and guardianship provisions and powers of attorney. Do that today if you haven't done it. Next, consider maybe a revocable trust, a revocable living trust. You can do that online. I often recommend that people find a trusted estate lawyer to do that with because it is a process that you can tailor to your needs. Something that most people don't know is that you can put stuff into your trust that's way more than just here's what is owned and here's where I want it to go when I die. Like I said, it's a document that can speak for you when you can't speak for yourself. So my trust talks about the type of care I would like to receive if I'm incapacitated. And it says some things that are a little bit, maybe you would say, frivolous. I would like to be brought outside regularly if I was in a spot where I couldn't care for myself. You can put really whatever you want. I have also prescribed specific mentors for my kids. If I was to die prematurely, it says there is money in this trust. And one of the purposes which I direct the trustee who's going to take care of this money to do with this, if I'm not here and I have children under a certain age, I want them to have a funded visit with a variety of people. Steve, you're on that list. I was like, thank I want you. Them to bump into the Manuel family on a regular basis. I said, I have a cousin who is a financial planner who I really trust. And I said, I want him not to just manage their wealth. I want him to have some paid time to just walk my kids through smart money principles that if I died tomorrow, maybe there's things I didn't get to cover with them.
That's awesome.
And you can do this with pastors. You can do this with any type of mentors. I want them to, you know, our family, we've always, I was going to say played polo. And then I'm like, if you've always played polo, you have an irrevocable trust and you're in the next bucket that That's we're right. about to talk about. But whatever polo. You guys do, you can fund that and you can be very prescriptive. So don't be afraid to do that in your trust and consider making one if kind of you're in that spot.
Okay. Great ideas. I love all that. Okay. Now we're ready to get into estate taxes. Yes.
The last thing we're going to talk about is the immorality of the greatest sham and scandal that our government runs. That's estate taxes. So let's talk about estate taxes for a second. Few things get me hot and riled up more than estate tax. I think it's the most immoral thing ever. It is a purely redistributive tax that says, if you die with more than a certain amount of money, we're taking 40% of it. And that's money that's already been taxed. You earned it. You paid income tax on it. You might have paid capital gains tax if you invested to get to it. And for no other reason than you died, we come in and say, yeah, we'll take it now. I hate it. I think it's terrible.
Can we use the word predatory as if there's a hyena just looking for a deer with a limp? An impala, perhaps a beautiful impala with a limp, and then going after it. And just for the sheer fun of it, just killing something. That's how I think of our government and its awful estate tax laws. Just licking its chops to just take your money that, as you say, you've already paid taxes on, you earned it, it was yours, and now they just take it.
Yeah, all of those things, yes. I think that the good news is that smart people don't generally pay estate taxes.
Oh.
I hear a lot of people, even in my work, they come to me and they say, we're really worried about estate tax. We don't want to pay estate tax. I say, great, let's talk about it. How much wealth are you dealing with here? And they'll say, we have done really well. And they have. We have, let's say, $2 million worth of investments, a home that's worth $1 million, and maybe we have two rental homes that are worth $1 million total.
All right.
So we've got a $4 million net worth. And the last thing we want is for the government to come in and take half of that when we die.
Sure.
And to them, I say, I have good news. Currently, the estate tax law is that every individual has an exemption amount, meaning that when you die, you can pass on up to the exemption amount with zero estate tax. Do you know what that amount is, Steve?
No, but I haven't a guess that it's maddening.
No, it's actually pretty high.
It's okay.
$13.61 million per person at the moment, which means,
okay.
And there's an unlimited marital exemption, which means if you're married, you can pass, and you've got $2 billion, you can pass all of it to your spouse. No estate tax when you die. It's going to happen when the second person passes away. But for most people today, if they die and they don't have, you know, $26, $27 million, there's no estate tax issues. Now, there are certain states like Washington that have an estate tax, but for most people, estate taxes are not actually an issue. We've talked about this in the past, but when we do a financial plan for a couple that's 30 and that's saving aggressively and trying to build up wealth, and we show them, here's how much we project that you're going to have when you're 80. A lot of times their eyes pop out of their heads and go, we're going to be bazillionaires. And I say, Over time, money becomes worth a whole lot less. It used to be true when our grandparents were kids that a millionaire was like, holy smokes, that's a millionaire. Nowadays, you pretty much must be a millionaire to retire in the United States. We could talk about whether that's always true or not, but for most people, you're going to need at least $1 million in order to fund your life when you are no longer able to earn income. And so while $26 million sounds like an astronomical number now, for some people, they're actually going to get there just with diligent savings and investment. Certainly, they could get there in two generations, meaning you are diligent and save, and maybe you leave a fifth of that amount to your family, but then they do the same things you did. Now we're there. So that's the exemption amount. The bad news is that amount is scheduled to be cut in half on January 1st of 2026. So now, instead of 13 million, we have 6.5 million that's available for tax-free inheritance. And that number could, in the past, it's been, I think in 2010, it was infinity. There was a lot of billionaires that suddenly died in their sleep, I think, in 2010. But and in other years, it's been much, much lower. So we really just don't know. This is all Congress deciding, here's what the estate tax is going to be. And I'll tell you, the United States is not exactly currently sitting on a huge glut of extra money. The odds that somebody comes in and goes, let's just take it from the rich people, pretty high. So we want to always have our finger on the pulse of this. But at the moment, $13.61 million per person, scheduled to get cut in half in a couple of years.
Amazing.
Okay. How do we deal with this? Let's say that you are in that group of people who maybe you don't have $27 million, but you go, we live in a high-cost area, we're saving, we might have $13 million between the two of us by the time we die. There are vehicles called trusts that we've talked about before on the podcast. Wealthy families will often use trusts as a way to move assets out of their estate and into a separate entity so that they are not part of your estate when you die. Now, the way that the estate tax works is that you actually have to, let's say that I have $1 million asset right now. We've talked a lot about compound growth, whether that's a piece of real estate or an investment account or whatever. We would expect that thing to double in value every 7 to 10 years. So we could move it into an irrevocable trust right now. And now the way the estate tax works is we've used $1 million of our future exemption. So we've used it. So if it stayed at $27 million, now we have $1 million less. We took this asset, we put it in a trust. We made ourselves the beneficiary of the trust. So we can still enjoy the benefits of that account or that property or whatever it is. but it's out of our trust. Why would we do that? Because the value of the thing is going to grow. And we've done this in some cases to take as little as $500,000 worth of somebody's long-term estate tax exemption and get like a $20 million business out of their estate. And so this is why I say that really wealthy people generally don't pay estate taxes until you get into the stratosphere. And if I wasn't a financial planner, I think I would have gone back to law school to learn all these fancy tricks, because I think that they're doing noble work, the estate planning attorneys who help families avoid this tax, which again, I will say, immoral, evil. But those are irrevocable trusts. And the price you pay for executing this move is that you can't just easily go and say, ah, I changed my mind. I want that thing back in my name. I want to own it. There's administrative prices. Now that trust is its own person in the eyes of the law. So it's got to file a tax return. You're going to have to pay somebody to do that. But for some people, absolutely worth it. We're going to save half of the value of this thing in the long term by getting it out of our estate. Those are irrevocable trusts. If you think that you're in that spot of, wow, I think it's time to start talking about an irrevocable trust, that's when I say, for sure, when you're in that bucket, it's time to bring in a team around you of people. So that could be financial planners. That's certainly estate planners. Definitely consider building a team of trusted people to navigate that. But that's it. We've talked about from top to bottom. If you're trying to build multi-generational wealth, I want you to think first about how to build a family that could potentially have multi-generational wealth handed to them without squandering it. I want you to then think about how to train and craft vision and all of this stuff such that they feel like they're going somewhere and not just, we're good at building piles of money. That's not a very exciting thing. And then I want you to be savvy. We have brothers and sisters in countries right now who are thriving in systems where they would be murdered if they were to be discovered as Christ followers.
True.
So we can trust the Lord, but we're also going to be shrewd, and we're going to take advantage of every legal avenue that allows us to perpetuate wealth and deploy it in service of the King wherever we find it.
Excellent. Very good, Mark. So next time we see you, we're going to start moving up the capital's ladder. We're going to talk about intellectual capital, how to protect it, and physical capital, how to protect that. Until then, run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.